All right, so we this week's Parsha is Parsha's Mishpatim. And just to give you a chronological sense, the Mishpatim, the chapters 21, 22, 23, talk about God tells Moshe, we call it in broad strokes civil law, like the laws of damages, the laws of watchmen, if your property damages other property, such as your animals damage other property, a theft, all kinds of penalties with regard to theft and robbery, and, you know, the basic element of a civil society, okay? And that's what the first three chapters. And the chapter 24 talks about the next day of the revelation at Sinai, day two of the Sinai. So basically, they hear, just to put the chronology down so you guys know the basic facts. On the sixth day of Sivan, which we celebrate Shavuot on, that morning the Jews heard the Ten Commandments. Okay? Am I clear about that? They hear the Ten Commandments. I mean, there's a debate. What exactly did they hear? Did they hear all ten? Did they hear the first two? Did they hear it as a created voice, like the Ralbag says? Did they have a prophecy? Oh, these are issues which are debated robustly. Then Moshe goes into the cloud and he receives the Mishpatim, the basic civil law, the 57 mitzvot, which are composed of this week's parsha. He tells the Jewish people these mitzvot. He writes them down. The next day, he tells it to them again. And that's the end of the parsha. They do a korban. They do an offering. Moshe sprays the blood upon them, part of their conversion into Judaism process. They, of course, say the famous phrase, Na'aseh v'nishma. We will listen and we will do. Okay? And then so by the next day, on the seventh day of Sivan, based upon that chronology, they heard he reads from the text of the Mishpatim a second time. Then they say Na'aseh v'nishma. And then the Jews have done all the parts of the conversion process. They did the circumcision for men in Egypt. They, before 3 days before, they immerse in a mikvah, men and women. They hear the Ten Commandments plus the Mishpatim, so they get a selection of sort of a poo-poo platter of mitzvot, sort of a summary of all the mitzvot. They accept the mitzvot. They say, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will hear, we'll do. In other words, they heard enough to be able to make a informed decision, okay? They do the korban, and then by the next day, they are now fully Jews. The Jewish people will be. So if somebody asks you a question, When did the first Jew exist? It's a trick question. You could say on one hand it's Avraham Avinu, right, because he had the philosophy of Judaism. But in reality, all the Jews became Jews together on the second day of Revelation, the second day after hearing the Dibros, when they said Na'aseh v'nishma. Okay, is everybody clear upon the chronology? Okay. Because there'll be a test on this. All right. So that's the basic the order. All right. We're going to focus upon the last part of the Mishpatim here. The class's title is called Holidays 101, Moshe's First Presentation of the Three Festivals. We'll see how it's presented, which is very interesting. But of course, we're going to start with a video. Okay, Okay, so this video is called The Pursuit of Happiness. Who's seen that movie, The Pursuit of Happiness with a Y?
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's a classic movie. It's a good movie. It's worthy of a rent, a Netflix, whatever manner you watch movies nowadays. You can watch it on your phone, on your watch, however you see movies. Okay. Anyways, here we go. There's the last 2 minutes. We're gonna go to the last 2 minutes. Here we go. Let me just set up the movie. So basically, the movie depicts a very inspiring story where Chris Gardner essentially has his child, and it's for a year, is basically homeless. And he got into this training program, E.F. Hutton, I think, to be a stockbroker. And now it's the last...
There's a great quote.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's inspiring. I think Will Smith was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor. I think he did not get it, but whatever. Anyways, so this is the last day of the training service, and then we'll go to the, shall we say, let's go to the videotape.
Wear one tomorrow, okay? Because tomorrow's going to be your first day. If you'd like to work here as a broker, would you like that, Chris? Yes, sir. But we couldn't be happier. So, welcome. Was it as easy as it looked? Part of my life, this little part, is called happiness.
Okay, guys. All right, so let's go to the other. Okay, now, those who've seen the movie, why was he, in addition to just getting a job, why was he particularly so elated? Who can share, based on their knowledge of the movie, for those who did not see the movie, why was he overwhelmingly elated? And he actually describes the experience of what he just defined as being of happiness. Anybody know?
I mean, he was homeless. He was living in like a homeless shelter. So this is like his opportunity to like make a living and have upward mobility.
Right. I mean, and in addition to the physical, that now he's going to be able to make money and actually live a dignified life for him and his son, okay? But there's also a sense of the removing of the psychological lack of dignity. In other words, a sense of completely feeling like a complete loser all the time. And he was able to overcome, in other words, to do this program and be homeless and having to go like a nomad from one homeless situation to another with a child, which is extremely stressful. It's a true story. There was a Chris Gardner, and he actually became part of the, I think it was Dean Witter. He became part of the firm, and then he went on his own, and he made money, and he sold it for millions of dollars, and now he's an inspirational speaker. And his story was so inspiring, they made a movie. Okay, which is played beautifully by Will Smith. Anyways, now, let me just fine-tune it. Now, how would most people celebrate their victory if they were in Chris Gardner's shoes? Person gets a raise or a promotion or a new job. What is the manner of, what is the Minhag HaMedina? What is the American custom? What does one do?
Go out and celebrate.
Okay. All right. And who are you going to invite?
You know, family and friends.
Family and friends. And what kind of place are you going to go to?
Someplace nice.
Nice restaurant.
Yeah.
Someplace nice. A nice, a decent restaurant, right?
Yeah.
And will there be beverages? What will be on the menu?
A few l'chaims, you know.
There'll be some l'chaims. Exactly. All right, so basically.
A steak dinner.
What? Steak. There you go. That's the number one. The number one for a guy. I mean, speaking for a guy. For a guy, the classic, even stereotypical situation, a guy got a big bonus or a raise or a promotion, he brings his whole mishpacha or his closest confidence and friend, and he takes them out to a classic American steakhouse, right? And it's sort of like a Viking victory. You feast on roasted meat. You drink fine wine and you say l'chaim to your unbelievable, amazing success. So that's really the nature. That's a normal. Would you say that depicts and characterizes the feeling that a person would have if they had got a big raise or bonus or job or promotion? Have we captured the experience accurately?
I think so.
Okay. All right. I bring that. That classic American experience, because we can take a look at the 23rd chapter by Mishpatim, which is dealing with various civil law. And then we're going to see something, how out of nowhere, seemingly nowhere, our holidays, our Pesach, our Shavuot, and Sukkot are introduced. So let's have somebody read. All right, Shana, you're on.
Do not accept bribery. Bribery blinds the clear-sighted and twists the words of the just.
Okay, stop. Who is that mitzvah essentially directed toward?
Judges.
Judges, correct. It's a law to the shoftim, but it's not limited to shoftim. I mean, and bottom line is, you could be in situations where you're supposed to be impartial. You know what I mean? In other words, in America, they have the phrase called conflict of interest rules, okay? In other words, if you are on a board, you have to be able to give, you cannot, for example, let's say you're on a board of a university, in a board of directors, okay? You cannot do a real estate transaction or a computer IT transaction with the company, with the university. Why? Why not?
Conflict of interest.
It's conflict of interest.
Correct, because the bottom line, and what they're concerned about, they call self-dealing. Who knows what the phrase self-dealing means?
It means you're doing something for yourself as opposed to the fiduciary responsibility you have to the organization.
100% correct. That's correct. In other words, they're fearful that you're going to sell them a product or service, which fundamentally puts money in your pocket, and it's not necessarily in the best interest of the organization. So they have all these conflict of interest rules and regulations for non-profit organizations and for-profit organizations, okay? So there's all kinds of rules and regulations. So, and that's also a terror idea. You know, you have to be, if you're a fiduciary, you have to be objective as much as you physically can, okay? Let's go on to the next mitzvah. Go on, Shana.
Do not oppress a foreigner. You know how it feels to be a foreigner, for you were foreigners in Egypt.
Rabbi Kaplan, you translate the word ger. Don't oppress the ger. The, foreigner here means technically a convert. Okay? So you're not, so what's the halacha? You're not allowed to oppress a convert. Who can tell me what that, what is that talking about? And there's two kinds of oppression that are prohibited with a convert, as is, it, you know, as is prohibited with any Jew. Well, there's a double.
But, sorry.
Yeah, anybody know?
Can you repeat the question?
What kind of oppression is being referred to in this, in the pasuk here about the, you can't oppress a convert? Give me an example.
Slavery.
Well, certainly a slavery. Yeah. What else?
Treating them harshly or not allowing them to enter the community just because they converted.
Right. So it has, it breaks down to two categories. It's called Ona'at Devarim, which is verbal oppression. In other words, you know, teasing them, insulting them, you know, referencing their past. Okay, you know how to do that. And there's Onat Mamon, and there's financially oppressing them, otherwise known as ripping them off, cheating them. Okay? So the Torah tells us that, and that's why it's also associated with the judge, you got to be careful that people are not involved in the oppression of the convert. Now, there's a prohibition to oppress any Jew, but there's a, why is there an additional why are there additional prohibitions to protect the convert?
They might not be aware of their rights or protections within Hebrew ethics, so you have to kind of stand up for them and let them know what their protections are.
Okay, so you're saying one, and they may not know. But if you're saying don't oppress the convert, what is the assumption of the pasuk?
People are oppressing.
Why would people be more likely to oppress the convert than the regular Jew?
They think less of them.
They think less of them. Okay, what else? That's true. Just let's fill it out. What challenges does a convert automatically have when they come to the Jewish community?
Being accepted into the Jewish community.
So what problem is there?
That they're not always easily accepted.
Why not?
Yes, they're not born into the community.
And therefore what?
People judge them or don't let them in so easily.
Right, they're treated like an outsider. So they come to the community, they have no connections in the community. And therefore people treat them as somebody, you know, since they were not born into the religion, people treat them as second-class citizens, right? And therefore, and since they're not connected, people feel they can maybe get away with ripping them off or treating them unjustly. You know what I'm saying? Because they don't have built in other words, if you have a regular Jew, well, he has parents, he has brothers, he has sisters, he has cousins, he has friends from school, camp, shul, etc. He has a whole network. This person has no network. So basically, they are much easily able to be victimized. All right? Let's go on.
That's in some ways, that's similar to like the Balei Teshuva.
A Baal Teshuva also does experience a similar thing because even though that they're a born Jew, but if they come into the Orthodox community, they oftentimes lack the social connections. They didn't go to any of the schools. They didn't go to any of the camps. They didn't go to any of the, you know, so they don't have the built-in social network, so they have to sort of like bust in, which of course is not simple. One of the ideas at MJE is that A, we create a community of Balei Teshuva or people who are searching, that's one. Two, we weave in people who've been FFB, i.e. the fusion and the tutors on one-on-one learning, a way for people to organically build their network. That, you know, that's not done by accident, that's actually done by design. I'm telling you all the secrets here. All right? Among other things, okay? All right, let's keep on going, Shayna. You're doing a great job.
You may plant your land for 6 years and gather its crops. But during the seventh year, you must leave it alone and withdraw from it. The needy among you will then be able to eat from your fields, just as you do, and whatever is left over can be eaten by wild animals. This also applies to your vineyard and your olive grove.
All right, stop. So what is the, so what's this mitzvah? What do we call this mitzvah?
Shemitah,
the sabbatical year. And the Torah here, when introducing this mitzvah, gives you sort of a reason for this mitzvah. What is the reason of the mitzvah?
So the needy can
let the land regenerate.
Doesn't say that here.
It's for the needy to eat.
Right. It says, so if you, so therefore on the seventh year, the crops, many times, the apple orchards will continue to grow, the pomegranates, the olives, the grapes, they grow automatically, right? Those who are with us this past summer, and summer's in the past, we go to Israel, we go to all the vineyards, you see the beautiful vineyards, the vineyards don't stop on the seventh year. So logically, the land becomes ownerless. And anybody can go in there and take a portion of food. You know what I'm saying? Particularly for the poor. Okay? So basically, part of building the civil society was to build in a number of safety nets. One safety net is Shemitah, where basically nobody is the owner of any land. You can go into any field you want and take whatever you want. Okay? The entire country becomes one food pantry. Okay? Let's go on.
You may do whatever you must during the 6 weekdays, but you must stop on Shabbat. Your donkey and ox must then be able to rest, and your maid son and the foreigner must be able to relax. Be very careful to keep everything I have said to you.
Okay,
do not...
Right there. All right, so what mitzvah is being referenced to in verse 12 and 13, 12?
Shabbat.
And there's a reason being given here. What's the reason for Shabbat?
To rest and relax, not just yourself, but your animals and anyone who works for you.
Okay, so that's another safety net. Basically, when there was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you had people who were poor, stuck working factories, also in America, like in the sweatshops, working 14, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, because America was a Christian nation, so they had off on Sunday. But if it wasn't for that, what would a owner of a factory want?
7 days a week.
7 days a week. The natural person is to of an owner of a business to have his workers work all the time. You may feel that your boss has that mentality. So built in is that not just Shabbos, is not just for Jews. It's not even just for people, but even your animals get a rest. There's something, Stephen Covey, and I recommend this book. It's a secular book. Still has a lot of wisdom. He has his 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. One of his rules, I think is rule number 2 or 4, I forgot to look it up online, called sharpen the saw. He says a person, in order for the metaphor is a saw. If you use your saw every single day, all the time, what happens to your saw?
It gets dull.
It's dull.
It becomes dull and ineffective. So you have to spend time to sharpen the saw. By analogy, you are the saw. And then he points out a person needs physical recovery, psychological recovery, mental recovery, and spiritual recovery. So my response back to Stephen Covey says, yeah, we're on that already. We have a simple term for that. We call that Shabbos. So that's our sharpening the saw. And it's not just for Jews, but you should not have your workers working on Shabbat. You shouldn't have your animals working on Shabbat. Okay. Let's keep on rocking and rolling.
Be very careful to keep everything I have said to you. Do not pronounce the name of another deity. You must not let it be heard through your mouth.
Okay, so it's not talking about just merely pronouncing it. It means like in the pronouncing in the sense of using another god. In the oral law is to use another, the name of a foreign god as a term of an oath. In other words, to swear by Jesus, let's say. You're prohibited to do that. You can't. You cannot use his name as a foundation of an oath or a swear. Okay. All right. So that's another part of related to the previous. Again, they were talking about mishpat. So in regards to justice, you have the use of if you get into a business deal and the guy says, well, in addition to this contract, I want you to make an oath by my God that you're going to follow through with all the stipulations of the contract. You're not allowed to do that, okay? It's part of our abandonment and distancing ourselves from idolatry. We stay away from idolatry, and we can't even use it for, let's say, business purposes. Even if you don't really believe in the God. Okay, now we get to our little now. Here we go.
Question on that?
Sure.
If a Jewish person then is taking like a witness stand or is getting sworn into office, their swearing in would be on a Jewish Bible then?
You could bring a Jewish Bible.
Okay. Offer a sacrifice to me 3 times each year. Keep the festival of matzahs. Eat matzahs for 7 days as I commanded you during the prescribed time in the month of standing grain, since this is when you left Egypt. Do not appear before me empty-handed. Also, keep the reaping festival through the first fruits of your produce that you planted in the field. There is also the harvest festival right after the end of the year when you gather your produce from the field. 3 times each year, every male among you must appear before God, Master of the universe. Do not sacrifice the blood of my Passover offering in the presence of leavened bread. Do not allow the fat of my offering to remain overnight until morning. Bring your first fruits to the temple of God your Lord. Do not cook meat and milk, even that of its mother.
Okay. All right. So now the Mishpatim says there's offer a sacrifice or celebrate with a sacrifice 3 times each year. And what are the 3 festivals? We call them in Hebrew regalim. What are the 3 festivals?
Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot.
Now, what is there? Now, the Torah introduces the holidays 4 times in the Chumash. The first one is here, in Parshas Mishpatim. The second time is in Parshas Emor in the book of Vayikra. Third time is in Parshas Pinchas in the book of Bamidbar. And the fourth time is in Parshas Re'eh in Devarim. 4 different presentations of the holiday. So this is the first presentation. And each one, a new layer of a meaning is being shared. So what I want to focus on tonight is, you know, how are the holidays, the 3 festival holidays being introduced to us? What are their focus? And I guess, what is the most strange thing that, you know, what's the most strange thing with all the flow of, we don't accept bribery, don't oppress the convert, we have to do the Shemitah year, we have Shabbat, don't make a vow in the name of another God, and then we have the law of the 3 regalim festivals, and then we have bring your first fruit to the temple, and then don't cook meat and milk. What is the obvious question here, guys?
What do these have to do with each other?
Exactly. It seems to be what they call simply a non sequitur. In other words, it's like we're talking about civil law. All right, so go on. Like another, you know, talk about robbery, talk about theft, talk about charging interest, talk about, you know, fair weights and measurements, talk about how you have to treat your employees, you know what I'm saying? Which they were talked about earlier, right? Then the Torah comes in here with the regalim. So we just have to, it's a little bit shocking. And would you call the regalim, the festivals, a mishpat? What is a mishpat? How would you translate mishpatim, mishpat? What do you guys say? The examples before are clearly mishpatim. How would you translate the word mishpatim? Anybody have an idea? It's also the name of the parsha. Anybody have any idea? All right, so I will tell you. So mishpat is generally translated as civil law. Law that deals with personal property, how you relate to the property of another, okay? Civil law, or in America you call it torts, other fancy words, okay? But basically property law, civil law, laws of commerce, okay? Those are mishpatim. So what would you not call it? So we have an entire cascade of mitzvot that are mishpatim. What does not fit into the mishpatim here? What is not a mishpat?
Meat and milk.
Okay, so that's another weird one. The prohibition of cooking milk and meat, and I guess by extension, eating it. And what else?
Regalim.
In the regalim. So how does this fit into the whole schemata? Okay, so is everybody clear on the question before I go on? That's a pretty clear question, right? All right, we're going to do a little bit of Ramban. All right, so let me have, Sean, you read the Ramban. This is the Ramban. This is taken from his introduction on the Parsha. When the Torah says, "Ve'elam mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem," these are the judgments or civil laws you Moshe Rabbeinu must put before the Jewish people. Okay, all right, let's read it out.
And these are the judgments. Why of all the commandments of the Torah does Hashem give these laws at this point? Ramban explains the reason for. And these are the judgments that you shall place before them. Is that Hashem wanted to present to the people the judgments, i.e. monetary laws, first. For we see that since in the 10 statements, the first statement was regarding...
Now, 10 statements it means the Aseret HaDibro, the 10, what we call 10 commandments, but more accurately translated as 10 statements, or 10 principles. Go on.
All right, so the first statement was regarding knowledge about Hashem. And the second was regarding the prohibition against idolatry.
All right, no. So the first myth says, "I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt." That is the verse that's an obligation to believe and know that there is a God. That's the first one of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God, okay? The second one is there should be no God before me. That's a prohibition of idolatry. Go on.
Hashem then continued and commanded Moshe after the 10 statements were given, "So shall you say to the children of Israel, you have seen that from the heavens I have spoken to you," meaning that you should warn them further that they should pay attention to what they have seen, and they should be vigilant about these commandments that I have commanded them.
Good.
For you have seen corresponds to the first statement, "I am Hashem your God, and you shall not make with me gods of silver and gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves." Corresponds to the second statement, "There shall not be to you other gods in my presence." In order to complete the subject of idolatry.
I stop right there. So what the Ramban is doing, which is very interesting, and we didn't have class last week, I would like to have explained that, but I was sick as a dog, is that the 10, I want to tell you sort of the punchline. The 10 commandments are not 10 commandments. They're 10 categories of the 10 governing principles of Judaism. Now, what the Ramban is saying, now if you look what Moshe tells the Jewish people after the 10 commandments, is really building out each one of the Ten Commandments. So so his first thing he tells the Jews is, remember that you saw that God spoke to you from heaven. Well, that's part of building out the idea of knowledge of God. But you have to know this idea that God, there was a revelation. That's something you have passed on to your kids. The second thing is that what you saw, you should not replicate that or depict that in gold and silver. That's a prohibition of God, of idolatry. Okay? In other words, he's showing how each additional thing that Moshe says is sort of picking up a motif, a theme of the Aseret HaDibros. Now the question is, so what does our Torah portion of Mishpatim, judgment, civil law, monetary law, which one of the Ten Commandments does that pick up? Okay? He continues on. Similarly,
and these are the judgments. Corresponds to the tenth statement, you shall not covet.
Covet.
For if a person does not know the law governing a house or a field or other property, he will think that it is rightfully his, and he will covet it and take it for himself. Therefore, he said to Moshe, place before them just judgments that they should practice among themselves, and thereby they will not covet what is not legally theirs.
Okay, let's start with the most basic word. What does it mean to covet? What's coveting?
Wanting something that somebody else has that you don't have.
Good. So that's halachically defined as desiring something that your friend has that they don't, that is not typically for sale, like their wife or husband, or their, you know, or their house, or their, you know, their primary property. Okay? So coveting is working out a plan to get an object which is not for sale and nudging the heck out of that person so the person will sell it. Okay? Or by a wife. This is actually a movie. I forgot what movie. What was the movie where the guy said to, where one guy, I think it was, blank on the guy, where he says to the guy, I'm leaving a checkbook on the table. You write a check, whatever you want, to divorce your wife so I can marry her. What movie? Anybody see that movie? Good. You should see
something. You're talking about Indecent Proposal?
Indecent Proposal is correct. Boom! Gotcha, right? That's the indecent. Yeah. That's an indecent proposal. That covers.
It wasn't exactly offering to pay for their divorce. More like, you know, just one night.
Whatever, but it's a similar idea. Yeah. That's coveting his wife. He's not supposed. That's off limits. Okay. All right. So what's the Ramban's idea here? He says that the chapters 21, 22, and 23, which give a build out of the basics of Jewish civil law, is really an extension of the 10th Dibra, the 10th statement of thou shalt not covet. Because in order to not covet, you have to know what belongs to you and what belongs to your friend. And to have those identities of property clear, okay? Very important. Then he's going to go a little further. This is a blowaway statement. Go on.
Ramban cites a statement of the sages. And thus did the sages say in Midrash Rabbah, the entire Torah depends on monetary laws. Therefore, the Holy One, blessed is He, gave the monetary laws immediately after the 10 statements.
Okay, stop right there. That's a dramatic statement. That's a mic dropping statement. I want to understand that tonight. The Ramban quotes a statement from the Midrash that says, the entire Torah depends on monetary law. Therefore, God gave the laws, the monetary laws, immediately after the Ten Commandments, the Ten Statements. Now I ask you all, what does it mean the entire Torah depends on monetary law? I mean, I know it's important. Why is it so important? Why is it that that's the most important thing that God's got to tell the Jewish people right after the Ten Commandments? Who can explain that to me?
Well, maybe like if people like broke the monetary laws, then they wouldn't be able to fulfill like other mitzvahs.
Why not? Let's say I steal from my clients every day. Does that prevent me from not keeping kosher in Shabbat?
Well, maybe, because if you steal, then you're not having the emunah in Hashem that be happy with your lot, like whatever you have is from Hashem. So kind of leads to, okay, then why keep kosher? Why keep Shabbat? It kind of has that domino effect.
So you're saying, but if you talk about the domino effect, then that would really apply to any area. So, oh, they should talk about the laws of kashrut. So if you don't do that, you could always claim the argument of this. You're giving me called the slippery slope argument. If you mess up in this area, you're gonna slide all the way down.
Okay. Well, how about this then? In the times of like Noah, the reason for the whole like flood and like basically destroying humanity was because of this. Was there a lot of like stealing going on and
destroying
each other? And
good. I like that. Okay, build it out. Build it out. The entire Torah is depending upon monetary law, mishpat, civil law.
Or like, do you want your others say you want to be like done to you?
Well, that basically is the core principle that undergirds all the many of the civil law. Yeah. All right, so therefore what? But just, I'm saying you're on the right path, but I want you to tell me, not me to tell you. Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe like you need to like respect other people first to have a foundation, and kind of leads to like Amunah and like the belief in Hashem.
Well, let me explain. They already got the foundational mitzvah of Amunah is the first Dibra. They already got that already. Okay. Right? And they got Shabbos, then they got the Ten Commandments. They got that first. Now,
all right, well, okay.
The question is, what's next?
And in order for society to function, you need to have the monetary laws. It'd be just chaos.
Okay, so that's the key point. In other words, the you have to look at Judaism not as a personal code, which is the way that we experience it, but as a national constitution, a national pathway. You know what I'm saying? And we're not talking about how each individual Jew will grow to be more perfected and more developed than they were before. We're talking about a foundationally new society. This is the birth of a new society. Now, sometimes it's helpful to figure out things in reverse. Let's say God would not give them the Mishpatim. How would the Jews in the desert and in the land of Israel conduct themselves between them and their fellow Jews?
It would be violent.
Well, human nature is like greedy and greed. So if these laws like didn't exist, then there would be chaos. Like, I feel like money is the root of a lot of issues.
What in their mind is the example in their mind of a society? Where are they coming from?
They're coming from Mitzrayim, and they actually have no experience with money or anything of that sort because they were slaves. So that makes
So even though that they were slaves, they still were part. They may have been on the lowest rung of the economic ladder. You see, the Jews did leave out of with cattle. They had some. They did have homes, or they had some possessions that may have not been. Initially they were not. They were obviously not wealthy. They lived in Egyptian society. They were the lowest rung of Egyptian society, so they saw how Egyptians lived. So fundamentally, what is the mission of the Torah?
The mission of the Torah is like, it's more of like, it's like living a life of Torah, Mitzvot, and the way that the Egyptians lived was not living a life of Torah. It was greed, it was multiple polycystic society. So I guess it's to sort of undo whatever, like the trauma that they, I don't know.
And that's 100% correct. Basically, the Torah is trying to undo all the corrupt values they picked up naturally, organically from Egypt. In Egypt, they believed in polytheism, in multiple gods. Here, they're clarified there is one source of existence, one God. In Egypt, they obviously they were the victims. That's what we read earlier. You know, don't oppress the convert because you were a stranger in a land among you. Know, don't forget that experience. In other words, have empathy, have sympathy for those people who are not part of the quote unquote in group. Okay, we have to be respect. Every person has property values because a person who's a Tzelem Elohim, who's created in the divine image, has intrinsic rights, or as the Constitution says, inalienable rights. And that is and that is to be able to possess and make decisions about their own property. So what is the first thing that God has to teach the Jews about? Even before they accept themselves as Jews, they remember, they don't accept themselves to become Jews till the very next day, the seventh day of Sivan, when they say, Na'aseh v'nishma. So before they accept becoming Jews, he needs to give them 57 mitzvot of civil law, mostly civil law. Okay? Now, so the cornerstone in order to have a, and this is what Deshaun rightfully brought up, the analogy is the most extreme example of a society without mishpat is the era of the flood, Noah's generation, who got down to an anarchist circumstance when each person was basically involved in wholesale robbery of the possessions and property of their neighbor. Okay? So it's something you, without civil law as a foundation, you cannot have anything else. That's why the says Kol HaTorah Kula Tluya B'Mishpat. The entire Torah depends on monetary law. Therefore, God gave us the monetary law immediately after the Ten Commandments. Okay. So. And the Ramban then says also, you see other, the immediate extensions of the Ten Commandments. Go ahead, read on, Sean, last line.
Ramban shows that this pattern can indeed be seen in other laws mentioned in our passage. And similarly, he elaborates in this Torah portion of Ela Hamishpatim, the law pertaining to idolatry, honoring one's father, murder, and illicit relations, which are all mentioned in the 10 statements.
So he's building out, he's wanted to show that this parsha is essentially a build out of the 10 themes already expressed in the 10 commandments. And the primary one is a lot of focus is on property rights, mishpatim. Okay? So is that clear? Now, with this background, I want to challenge you guys and go back to our original question. So tell me, how does the regalim fit into that system? How does that three times a year, after each one of the three harvests, first of barley, then of wheat, then of all the other produce, I need to take my produce, bring it to the temple and appear before God, and you know, bring, and I can't go, and I have to bring a gift to God, can't come empty handed. Okay, what's the deal? How does that fit into the mishpat system that the Torah has unfolded here?
It's what about thinking about society before yourself. So in an agricultural society, bringing those gifts to the temple was really, you know, a hard sacrifice to make, but it made people think about doing the right thing for the community than just about themselves.
Similarly,
I was just saying, similarly, you know, things about the other commandments, you really have to think about how is this going to affect other people more than what am I going to do right to myself here.
100%. So the Torah, in other words, going back to our initial video where we talked about if a person gets a raise, a new job, a promotion, the natural example would be is to go either in their home or in a restaurant and have a big celebration of themselves. Here, the Torah says, the blessings that you have received to God, you cannot take it. You have to take that and celebrate it with the rest of the Jewish people because you get blessing because of the rest of the Jewish people. Share it with the poor. That's going to be expressed later on in the Chumash. Giving to the Levi and the Kohen. And part of the holidays is really that when you have a meal and you have sacrificial meat in it, and we've learned this in this, you know, there's an obligation to include around the table the poor, the stranger, the convert, the widow. You have to make sure that everybody is included and that you have to ascribe that this blessing is coming from Hashem and not a personal, narcissistic celebration of the greatness of self. And that's why it's, when are the holidays?
At the harvest time.
At the harvest time. Now, imagine, you know, when a person gets a bonus, that's, how does a person feel about themselves?
Oh, hi, friends.
Good to hear. When a person gets a raise, how do they feel about themselves? They get a promotion. They get a new job.
They feel great.
They feel great. And it's not a time that it's easy to share that, you know, with everybody else. You really want to, a person who had a successful harvest wants to bring it into his own barn, his own house, bring his own family in there, maybe some close personal friends, and have a celebration of the self. Here, you have to have a national celebration and include the people who don't have. So it really punctures the natural self-centrism that all people are, the mitzri among us would want to engage in. It really punctures.
Right. I will say, Rabbi Penny, that we do it in the opposite way too. When tragedy strikes and stuff, like even the way like people said Shiva and things like that of that sort. So I think that there's things built in to keep us humble in regards to successes, but also when we fail.
Correct. Both are true. That's an excellent point. The person has to feel, in other words, for example, there's an interesting halakha. When a mourner comes back from the cemetery, there's a prohibition from them eating their own food. They call a sudat havra'ah, where the community provides food for the avel. Why? It's important that the person feel that their family may be reduced and they have been feeling knocked down, but part of the comfort is that you're part of a larger family and that family is the Jewish people. And they're there for you. And you're not allowed to eat of your own food. You must have you kick off your mourning with a meal of chesed, which is provided by the community. Okay? So that's on the sad point. But on the positive, when we have success, we share it with others. And not just any others, but even those people who do not have. Well, we're coming up on Purim pretty soon. It's a mitzvah we have in Matanos Avyona. We give money to the poor so they can also enjoy a robust Purim. And if you have a poor person who can join your Purim Suda, that's even more better. Now, I want to answer another question. It's already 9 o'clock. I don't want to go too much over time. What is the do not cook meat and milk business? How's that fit in? So the Rambam and his Moreh Avuchim speculated that this was a common activity of the celebrations of the idolaters, that they would cook the meat in the milk, you know, sort of like a little bit of a domination. In other words, you're cooking the kid in the milk of its mother. You know, there was a it was a little bit of a barbaric pagan activity there, which they would do principally in their temples around the holidays. That's a possibility. That's one possibility. There are many possibilities, but that would fit in thematically that part of the anti-mystery training, number one, is the utter respect of the of other people and an absolute concern for the people who are poor, concern for people who are orphaned, people who are widows, people who are convert, people who are oppressed, wherever they may be. And therefore, our celebrations are not personal celebrations, but are national celebrations. And they are woven into the activity of chesed and woven into the activity of tzedakah. And specific focus is not to allow go into a pagan manner. And that could be how that mitzvah is articulated. Now, the Torah does not give us a specific reason. That's his best guess. And there could be more than one reason. And there are many of the Rishonim give different ideas. What is the idea behind the mitzvah of not eating milk and meat? Cooking milk and meat and eating cooked milk and meat. So, but the main point here is that the key idea, the most basic idea of the holidays is that on the holidays, what do we appreciate? God's blessing. How do we show our appreciation for God's blessing? We share our blessing with those who don't have. And we had to go, and we turn this activity of joy into a day of service to Hashem. In the time of the temple, we'd go up to Jerusalem, all of us, and be there for the holiday. Now we go to shul, and we try to spend our Yom Tovim in a meaningful, spiritual way. And of course, is the activity of chesed. I want to share you a story that I heard. I gave a class about holidays, and the part of the mitzvah holidays is samachta bechagecha, you should rejoice in your holidays. And if a person turns away others who are poor, they do not get any reward for the rejoicing of the holiday because they've showed and demonstrated that they're rejoicing in the holidays, what they call simchat kreso, a rejoicing of the belly. I gave this class to women. It was about 25 years ago. And in the back of the class was a woman who was not a day younger than 90 years old. And she said, Rabbi, I want to share a story. She says, when I was a little girl growing up in the shtetl in Poland, before all the holidays, we would go to various homes, poor people's homes on the outskirts of town, and we would leave containers of food right before all the holidays. I remember going with my mom. So this is going back to the turn of the century. And she remembers that the culture of the Jew, when comes Yontif, it cannot be about yourself. It has to be including everybody has to participate in the national holiday. And she gave personal testimony, even though she was a little girl in Poland or in Russia, turn of the century in the shtetl. And even though they probably did not have a lot of food themselves, but they always shared with those who did not. And that was, in her mind, that's what a Yom Tov was. And that really is from the way the Torah depicts it. So that's a little bit of an idea of how Moshe, in his first of four presentation, teaches the Jewish people about there's a whole new world here. We're going to have a whole new society. We're going to treat people in a whole different way. And we're going to party in a whole different way. And it's going to be unbelievable. And that's what he tells. And then after this, the Jews in the next chapter say the famous words, Naseh v'nishma. Sign us up. We're in. We're on board. We're doing it. And that's how the Jewish people were launched. Any questions?
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that.
100%. I don't think that woman's alive anymore. I can't believe that she would be like, you know, well over 100. All right, guys. All right, guys. Have a great
Thank
night.
You. See you
tomorrow.
Good night.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good night.
Thank you. Tomorrow.